I'm very happy now to welcome poet Carol Muldaugh. She will be reading tonight at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 in the evening right here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. So good to be here.
Your poetry is really good, and it's very, we were talking before we went on the air about what makes for good versus mediocre poetry, and it's a crazy discussion that's very hard to come to any conclusions about, but why don't we start with a poem, and we will, you'll read a couple of poems during our conversation.
That sounds good. I'll start with a short poem called Out of the West. Out of the West, unexpected, lyric, a stand of yellow irises rises from the pond muck. Two horses graze the field, one limping from the fire they fled. Matter and spirit meet, love, argue, wherever you rest your eyes, a microscopic midges, horseflies.
Now, this is a book, your new book is called So Late, So Soon, New and Selected Poems. This is one of the new poems.
Yes.
And it seems that the question of matter and spirit is very much alive for you in the new poems.
It is. I think it's been there all along in my work, but it's something I'm thinking about in a more direct way now. And there are a couple of poems, this one and a longer one, and probably other places where I'm really trying to explore the relationship between matter and spirit, because it's what really interests and obsesses me in a way in life and in art.
It's something that it's hard to define. I mean, we know what matter is. It's the stuff that we are and that's all around
right.
us. What is spirit?
Well, that's what's so interesting, is we feel it, but we don't really know it. We can't put our finger on it. And I think the only way we can know it is when it's somehow, when it comes into matter. And they sort of have a symbiotic relationship in our world. Maybe in other dimensions it's different. But you know, matter is kind of inert without spirit, and spirit is unembodied without matter.
And then when you get down to an atomic or subatomic level, all matter is not inert at all.
It's not. And it must have spirit. So anyway, it's kind of a way of for me to think about the internal and the external, and what gives matter meaning, I guess, is what interests me.
I hope we can get as many poems as possible into our show today, because there's something that comes up over and over, which is that your writing is so very personal, and yet it always speaks to something outside of itself. I don't know if you want to call that objective or mm-hmm. or what, but is that something that you have to consciously do as a poet? Make sure that you're not just staying within your own personal life, because otherwise, who cares?
it's not quite like that for me. I know that the personal or the intimate is where I naturally start. I think we sort of all start wherever our temperaments are most comfortable or obsessed or something. And that's where I start. But I think that in writing a poem and in using language and in the kind of navigation between head and heart that I go through in that process, it doesn't stay in what I would think of as a kind of journal, intimate sphere. It just changes. And that's really when I get most interested, is when, you know, the language or the imagery or the poetic form, it's all, even if it seems intimate, it always seems outside of myself to me.
And it's interesting, because it's a process that starts in some place which is personal, and everybody writes in their journals, or a
right.
lot of people do, and then it gets into something else. And that transformation has a quality which is a really big deal. I don't know, mm-hmm. I mean, people have used the word alchemy to describe that kind of a
right.
process. But there must be some moment where you know that you've gone over the hump or turned the corner, or whatever the metaphor is.
There is. And that's when I, in a way, stop thinking, and I'm just engaged in the writing process, and it's not like a jigsaw puzzle, and it's not like a, you know, scientific experiment, but I guess I think of it there's two metaphors I use when I teach. One is that I have a tuning fork inside my head, and I'm writing to that tuning fork, and I can feel when it's, you know, got that chime, and that's when I know something's occurred, and that's what I'm going with and for. And the other is sometimes a poem to me, when I'm working on it, it feels like a sculpture, and I'm always kind of walking around all sides of it, to, you know, to look at it from all angles. It's very objective feeling to me, and then I'm sometimes startled by how, you know, intimate it seems.
There's a lot of sculptors have written about the process of doing sculpture, and of course there's two different approaches. One is you have a block and you take stuff away and the thing emerges, and the other is you add stuff to it until the thing takes shape. Is one of those more operative for you?
Well, I'm not sure which one. I mean, I tend to, I'm not a person who writes a ton and a ton, and so I suppose I'm not chipping away in that sense. I tend to write slowly and in little increments. So I suppose it's more like building it up.
We're talking to poet Carol Muldaw. Why don't you read another poem?
All right. This poem is from my first book, and I was tickled recently because it was published years ago, and I recently got an email from a man, I guess he, you know, found me on the internet, who said that he had read it years ago, and now he was getting married, and he wanted a copy for his fiance for their wedding. So I thought, oh, God, these, you know, you think nobody reads poetry, and then you discover it's made a difference in somebody's psyche for a long time. So that was a wonderful feeling.
What a beautiful compliment.
I know, it was. It definitely made my day, my month, whatever. Transmarine. An open hull nudging reeds and sand. She kept to herself the pleasure he provoked, the undercurrent dimpling as he stroked, and drifted, slackly moored under his hand. Turning to him, she let him loose the knot, drop the rope, and push his foot against the pier to lift her free. Her muscles tensed. He took her like a sail the wind had caught, and guided her until she guided him. And when there were no place that either knew, where sky and sea and shadow echoed blue, they plunged and were knocked back at the world's rim.
Carol Muldaw, there's something that I find fascinating, and it's sort of so obvious that no, you never really talk about it, and that is that sooner or later, all poets write about sexuality, mm-hmm. eros, and all of that. And sex and sexuality are such inherent and basic and primal biological things, and yet we have such a need to assign to them or discover in them meaning and metaphor and depth and richness and all of these things. And I sometimes wonder why?
Well, I mean, you have to have meaning in life, right? Or life becomes pretty barren and depressing. And I guess I wonder, you know, you say we assign the meaning to them, which would imply the meaning isn't inherent in
them. Or we discover.
I would say more that we discover, and I wouldn't say there's one meaning that we discover. I mean, I think there's lots and lots of meanings, and the meaning that you discover that is most pleasing to you or matters the most to you is the one you kind of go back for.
I guess I'm asking because I've been thinking a lot about, how do I say it? A lot of biologists and people who study science are looking at animals, and the line between human beings and all other animals seems to get blurrier and blurrier the more we learn about other animals. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if any other animals assign so much meaning to their sexuality. Everybody else just kind of uses it to reproduce and survive.
Right. Well, isn't it kind of an open question what meaning other animals assign to anything, you know, to life, to death, to their children, or you know, building their houses? I mean, we assign meaning to all sorts of things. We seem to have a deep need for meaning. And I think poetry, what's so wonderful about poetry is that it's a discovery of both that need and a way of filling that need, you know, through language. You know, I don't know very much about that question of animals, and I know there's a lot of animal languages and signals that go on in language, but for us, I think language is one way we approach meaning and poetry is one of the, you know, most distilled and kind of purest ways of doing that.
Let's hear another poem.
All right. Well, this one is a poem that is a New Mexico poem, and it's called Bosque del Apache. It comes out of a visit to the bird sanctuary. Winter. Scratchy branches flame upward, stiff as ratted hair. Crows crown the leafless trees, black buds that bloom in unison only to fly. At dawn, the marsh is crowded as a skating rink. Ducks land in squadrons, swim in pairs. Geese honk to be let by. Like them, we're stalled in traffic, caught in a cavalcade circling the one-way 15-mile tour loop, binoculars in every lap. We scout to see what we're missing and end by missing what we're seeing. The sky's too busy and too vast. Lavender-orange masses of clouds lit from below stagily surge and disperse, while from the farthest east, daylight's dark stars flap their wings, assume their shifting constellations, and stream over us, crossing the sky like corps de ballet after corps de ballet, undulant velvet ribbons trailing. Each bird, a basted stitch puckering the sky's pale blue satin smock. Each flock, an intricate design in thread the seamstress forgot to lick and double knot. And so it goes. A V of cranes unravels, rivaling the geese for noise.
Just the beauty of your use of language and syllables is astounding.
Well, thank you. That's to me, poetry is built from its syllables, from the resonance of sound as the syllables accrue, and that is what I love about it, really.
I noticed that in some poems you do use rhyme, but it's not really obvious, and one could miss it if you weren't looking for it.
Well, I like use of rhyme in that way. I like that it might have a resonance and it make the poem seem sonically richer, but that you're not aware of it and it's kind of thumping, it's going to come along at a certain place. Or I use a lot of off-rhyme, slanted rhyme.
What is that?
Well, that would be like rhyming... Well, I might not be using the technically right terms, but like lame and lime, you know,
right.
or same and sane, or vain and, you know, things that where the vowels might be the same and the consonants differ, or rather than, you know, oh, of course now I can't even think of the most, you know, sky and by, you
right.
know, which is a full rhyme. And I also don't always rhyme in a pattern, meaning you can't predict when the rhyme will happen.
Right.
So, and I enjoy that. I think it makes it a subtlety.
It's kind of like you're using a form, but very loosely.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. I think, you know, form is an interesting question. I like form, but I'm not crazy about what is considered formal poetry these days.
It's like sonnets.
Yeah, I mean, people write beautiful sonnets, but I think that when the conscious mind is preoccupied with questions of form, then it allows a lot of unconscious things to come out. So it actually can increase the wildness. But I don't like archaism, so I like it to feel contemporary to our world.
We're talking to poet Carol Muldaugh. Some of the poems are in memory of a person who died or written for a person who's living. Do you often write to a specific person? Does that affect how you write and how you think about your poetry?
Mostly, I mean, I have, you know, poems to my husband, certainly, and my daughter. And mostly, if somebody's living, I don't write a poem to them. But it does seem when people die, I want to commemorate them or my feelings for them or something, you know. So I do find that death, you know, when somebody dies, you're much more, they're present to you in a non-physical but deeply internal way, and that is something that is the perfect breeding ground for a poem. So I have found that I noticed that reading through this, you know, when I was putting the book together, that there are a lot of elegies.
There's a beautiful one to a man who died of AIDS.
Thank you. I that poem means a lot to me, and I think it was actually the first elegy I wrote. And it, and I wasn't able, and this has been true of a lot of the elegies, not able to write it immediately after his death. I think I wrote quite a bit, and then of notes in a way, and I put it away. And it wasn't until 3 or 4 years after he died that it actually was able to take shape as a poem.
Do you feel like the poems have, you know, here's another metaphor, seeds that are planted and then eventually they grow?
Yes, I do. And I do. And I think it's really important to not push things, you know, to not, what is it called, force blooming?
Right.
because I think a lot of poems that never quite work are poems that have been forced. I mean, of my own, in any case.
That's so interesting. And how do you different? How do you know when you're forcing something versus just working hard?
I think there's a more static quality, a quality that you're kind of running in circles when you're forcing it, or that there's an artificiality. It takes, you don't always know until later.
Yeah.
And then I also think with, you know, experience, you learn.
There was a teacher, a spiritual teacher, whose book I read many years ago, and somebody asked her a question about meditation, and she said that her meditation was to walk in the fields and look at the flowers in nature, and too much sitting still and meditating is like trying to force a flower to bloom before its time.
So very similar. I mean, when I write, sometimes you know, it's been going well, and suddenly I'm stuck for a word, and I'll just take a shower. And sometimes in the shower or when I get out, you know, that word is there. So maybe that's a similar thing. I also have written some poems from dreams. And I was just thinking when you said that about elegies, there's this very short poem, which is both. It's an elegy for a friend of mine who died from melanoma, actually. So he was youngish. Three years after he died, I had a very vivid dream. Should I read that one?
Yeah.
It's called Bone Soup. 3 years, still dead, but alive inside me. In a dream, talking to him on the phone, spooning soup from his bones.
Wow.
That was just quite a dream.
Good heavens.
Yeah, so I guess you get nourishment from the people, you know, that you've loved even when they're gone.
Soup being a metaphor for
nourishment, right?
Yeah. When you put together this book so late, so soon, new and selected poems, what was the process like of going through your old work and making these selections and putting them all in different categories and so on?
Right. It was really interesting for me. I had just finished my novel, The Widening, and I was very eager to get back to poems, and I was fortunate to have a writer's residency from the Lannan Foundation in Marfa, Texas. So, and I felt very removed from my poems because I'd been working on this novel. So it was really great for me to go through my previous books and, you know, think what do I still feel proud of? What still seems to feel fully vibrant or, you know, fully realized, and what just perhaps was more of a passing fancy or an exercise or a growth or, you know, that kind of thing. And it really helped me get back into the feeling of my own work. And it was really while doing that that I was able to start new poems. And from doing that, I did at first put them in categories like, you know, definitely, maybe, you know, maybe not, definitely not. I forget if I had 3 or 4 or 5 categories. And poems shifted in the categories. You know, you have to look at it more than one afternoon because there's a lot of mood and self-criticism involved as well. But it's wonderful to have because, again, that word distillation, it's, you know, for me, it's, I didn't get to put everything in it that, you know, that I wanted. I would still hope that the single books have, you know, wholeness and resonance, but I was able to sort of get most of what I thought was the finest of my work, and that feels great.
We're talking to poet Carol Moldahl. Every poet is influenced by poets who have gone before, and I was thinking as I was reading your book, there's so many potential influences within one poet. So is it their form, or is it their heart, or is it the subject matter? The poets whom you love and who've influenced you, what is it about them that you feel
right,
and use?
That's a wonderful, wonderful question. No one's put it quite that way before. You know, I think there's a sensibility that comes through language, a use of language. Sometimes you're influenced by people who are very, very different from you. And other times people you have a great sympathy for. But I think always it's the way they use language opens up worlds inside you, and you think, you know, I want to do something like that. And sometimes it can be very technical, like the way Elizabeth Bishop used rhyme, you know, I think has influenced me a lot in the ways we were talking about before. And some of the people who influenced me, I only know in translation. I mean, like Sappho, you know, just this exquisite, well, for us it's brevity because so much was lost.
Right.
But the keenness, you know, there. I mean, there have been a lot of influences over the years.
As a poet, do you always write from your own point of view, or do you do what fiction writers do and take on different characters?
I have taken on different characters once in a while. I think it's in this book. There's a poem called The Sorceress that I wrote from the point of view of a sorceress. But, you know, it's kind of that question of a, you know, they say certain actors like Katharine Hepburn or Cary Grant, they play different characters, but they're always playing themselves.
Yeah.
I think sometimes persona poems are similar. The character is a vehicle for something, you know, in you to come out. And I'm not that drawn to persona poems. I think I've done, you know, a few.
We're just about out of time. Let's go out with one poem, your choice.
Oh, okay. Well, I think I'll read The Peony, because actually I'll read it. I think of it as the transmission of poetic lineage. The Peony. A man cups his fingers as if to bring them to his lips to blow me a goodbye kiss, or as if he were Italian to underscore his words. He's not Italian. He is not speaking, and he does not bring his fingers to his lips. Gravely they descend upon a peony held up by the rim of its fishbowl vase. Because I would be his, he tells me a secret it is mine to know, all the while spreading the silky petals with his slowly opening hand, so that the peony is made to bloom to its fullest until it is an open globe overbrimming the vase. Only now do I think of those paper flowers that blossomed when we floated them in water as girls. The words of the secret blurred as soon as I woke, but his light hand gravely forcing the peony, that remains.
Carol Moldaw's new book of poetry is called So Late, So Soon, New and Selected Poems, and she will be reading tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.